Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present today Bill Davey, the author of the magnificent book Let Justice Be Done, subtitled New Light on the Jim Garrison Investigation. This book was published in soft cover by Jordan Publishing, and copyright 1999, and the ISBN number is 0-966-9716-0-4. Bill, welcome to our airwaves.
Thanks. It's a pleasure being here.
Bill, I first became aware of the Kennedy assassination in the early 1970s, and it was behind the Kennedy assassination that I came to the entire field of political research, which has been my life's calling. And from the time I first became aware of that assassination, I have been waiting for a book such as yours to appear. I couldn't praise it more strongly for the benefit of the audience, and I'd like to begin the interview by thanking you for writing this marvelous tome.
Well, thank you. I'm just sorry you had to wait so long for it.
Well, better late than never, I think, is the operant phrase under the circumstances. In one sense, I'd like to begin at the ending, and one of the real strengths of your book, I think, is its reliance on documentation that's come to light in the wake of the Assassination Records Review Board, which in turn was formed in the wake of the Oliver Stone film JFK.
Mm-hmm.
On page 202, you write as follows. House Select Committee on Assassinations Chief Counsel G. Robert Blakey once referred to the committee's work as, quote, the last investigation, unquote. As such, it is only proper that the House Select Committee on Assassination have the last word on Clay Shaw. On September 1st, 1977, Staff Counsel Jonathan Blackmer, that's spelled B-L-A-C-K-M-E-R, authored a 15-page memorandum addressed to Blakey, as well as staff members Gary Cornwell, Ken Klein, and Cliff Fenton. Blackmer was the lead counsel for Team 3, the House Select Committee on Assassinations team responsible for the New Orleans and Cuban angles of the investigation. After an investigative trip to New Orleans, Blackmer concluded in his memo, quote, "We have reason to believe Clay Shaw was heavily involved in the anti-Castro efforts in New Orleans in the 1960s and was possibly one of the high-level planners or cut out to the planners of the assassination." That, again, from a House Select Committee on Assassinations memo of 9-1-77, and that memo alone, to a large extent, vindicates Jim Garrison. Of course, Clay Shaw was the person whom Jim Garrison unsuccessfully tried for the assassination. One more brief quote, again, to illustrate what I think is the greatest of many strengths of your book. And by the way, it's also a very easy read, not a facile or light book, but it's not heavy reading as much political science is, and so I think it's accessible to a relatively wide segment of the reading public. Even the CIA, as you document, had come to the conclusion unavoidably that Garrison was basically, or that there was substance to his investigation. On pages 62 and 3, you write, "In early February of 1967, the chief of the New Orleans office," that parenthetically is the CIA office, "Lloyd Ray, authored a memo to the director of the Domestic Contact Service. In it, he wrote, quote, 'We believe that there is some truth in the allegation of the Garrison investigation, and that the matter is under a discreet and sensitive investigation by the FBI, unquote. Again, I think this and other documentation that you present would come as a revelation to many people who have been fed the official version of the Garrison investigation, which is that it's BS. And as I said, I think this is one of the great strengths and one of many of your book. Bill, for the benefit of people that are not familiar with the substance of the Garrison investigation, perhaps we should begin by outlining some of the basics of it for people that aren't familiar with it. Tell us about David Ferry, who he was, and his very strange trip to Texas the weekend of the assassination.
Sure. Well, what a lot of people don't realize is that the Garrison investigation actually began the weekend of the assassination when one of Garrison's assistant DAs received a tip that a New Orleans character by the name of David Ferry was associated with Lee Harvey Oswald, the accused assassin, and that Ferry had taken a mysterious trip shortly after the assassination occurred. He took a trip from New Orleans to Houston, Texas, with a couple of companions through a torrential thunderstorm. And once he got to Houston, Ferry sort of holed it up at an ice rink and proceeded to make phone calls from a payphone there, actually making and receiving various phone calls from a payphone, and never put on any ice skates. And Later, his two companions left Houston and then went to Galveston, Texas, and then later drove back to New Orleans, where Garrison's men were waiting for him as a result of the tip they had received.
Now, another of the things that sort of precipitated Garrison's investigation was a phone call that a New Orleans attorney named Dean Andrews got. Tell us about Dean Andrews and a, quote, Clay Bertrand, unquote.
That's right. Dean Andrews was an attorney in New Orleans who, in the summer of 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald had walked into his office and had asked him about working on having his dishonorable discharge upgraded, and also about some additional proceedings he wanted to have done for his wife, Marina.
By the way, that was a dishonorable discharge from the Marines for allegedly defecting to the Soviet Union. Go ahead, Bill.
That's right. And Andrews did some preliminary work for Oswald and would later testify to the Warren Commission that Oswald was accompanied by some, as he put it, gay Mexicanos or Latinos. And later he also said that Oswald's fees would be paid by a man named Clay Bertrand. Now, during the weekend of the assassination, Andrews was in a hospital in New Orleans recovering from a bout of pneumonia, and he received a call from a Clay Bertrand asking him to go to Dallas and represent the accused assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald.
Now, jumping ahead to a certain extent, by way of tying some of this in, when Clay Shaw, and we'll get to more of the actual investigation in a minute, but when Clay Shaw was actually booked by Jim Garrison, he had something very interesting to say to the fellow who booked him. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yes, when he was asked for any aliases, according to the booking officer, Aloysius Habegorst, Shaw replied, Clay Bertrand.
And, of course, that confirms what basically Dean Andrews had originally told Garrison, and that was much of the basis for Garrison's indicting Shaw.
Right. And later, it's sort of funny. They went through all sort of permutations of Dean Andrews' story and saying that he was under sedation at the time of the call and didn't know what he was saying. But as I've shown in the book, that when the FBI actually investigated that, they found out that Andrews was not under sedation at the time he received the call.
And Habegorst wasn't under sedation.
No, he wasn't.
And now, as I recall, Judge Haggerty would not admit that into evidence. Is that true?
That's correct. And again, as I point out in the book, it looks like that was probably a legal misstep by Haggerty, but nevertheless, it didn't get admitted into evidence, which I think would have been very damning evidence.
And one of many travesties of justice connected with the Garrison investigation. One of the key people who figures in the whole nexus around New Orleans is a guy named Guy Bannister. Bill, tell us about Guy Bannister, 544 Camp Street, and Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right. Guy Bannister was a former SAC, or special agent in charge of the prestigious Chicago FBI office. He left the FBI under sort of a cloud and went to New Orleans and became a deputy superintendent of police there. And he was in charge of the Red Squads, for one thing, as well as trying to clean up some of the graft. He left again under a cloud, a bit of a cloud there, too, and started his own private investigative agency called Guy Bannister Associates. Now, he had a building at 544 Camp Street. And Guy Bannister Associates really didn't do a lot of investigative work. Bannister mostly, he was a collector of intelligence and had a little side business going where he would run agent provocateurs. He'd have young men infiltrate supposed communist organizations. And in the summer of 63, when Oswald was in New Orleans, and he was the sole member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, it turns out on one of the pamphlets he was handing out, he had stamped on it the address 544 Camp Street. Now, Bannister's office was actually at 531 Lafayette, but 544 Camp and 531 Lafayette were both side entrances to the same building. And at the time of summer of 63, the only occupant of that building, aside from a couple of trade unions, was Guy Bannister. And several other people, Bannister Associates and so forth, have come forward and, have said they saw Oswald and Bannister together.
Now, of course, Bannister was a fierce anti-communist, and Oswald was an alleged leftist and pro-Castro activist. Which raises some very strange questions. You mentioned that there was apparently an order placed for some of those leaflets that Oswald was handing out while Oswald was actually in the Soviet Union.
That's correct. The first printing of those leaflets, which were the leaflets that Oswald was handing out, was printed while Oswald was in the Soviet Union, and it came to light that the largest or one of the largest bulk orders of those pamphlets came from the CIA.
Which raises more questions than it answers, but I think it certainly is one of many things that suggests very strongly that Oswald's actions in New Orleans were being handled by the intelligence community.
Yes.
Speaking of which, tell us about Guy Bannister and his connections to the intelligence community and the anti-Castro Cuban effort.
Right. Well, they sort of called 544 Camp the nexus or the nerve center of the anti-Castro activity in New Orleans. There was He was used as a weapons repository. There were anti-Castro Cubans in and out of Bannister's office. I was told by one of Bannister's investigators that Bannister was actually being used as a quote-unquote bagman for the CIA to fund anti-Castro operations, specifically some of the training camps in and around New Orleans.
Now, one of those training camps was at Lake Pontchartrain outside of New Orleans, and not only Bannister, but one of his employees, the aforementioned David Ferry, worked for that. Tell us about that, if you would.
That's correct. David Ferry worked very closely with Bannister in 62 and 63, and in one of those efforts, it was the training of the Cuban exiles, and that training took place at a camp north of New Orleans across Lake Pontchartrain, at a property owned by a man by the name of McClaney, who, as it turns out, was an associate of Jack Ruby's. But in the summer of 63, President Kennedy actually ordered the FBI to clamp down on these camps, and that was one of the camps that they closed down, and needless to say, that didn't endear Kennedy to any of the exiles or to Bannister and his crew.
They already weren't doing the varsity rag about his administration.
Right.
I'd like to interrupt briefly at this point to read another paragraph from your book. And again, Bill, I think this is exemplary of the greatest of the many strengths of this book, which is its reliance on official documentation in order to shore up Garrison's case. On page 30, you write as follows about the Lake Pontchartrain training camp. It is possible that a film once existed of this training camp. The former deputy chief counsel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, Robert Tannenbaum, recalled that the committee viewed the film, and to Tannenbaum it was a shock to the system. And then you quote Robert Tannenbaum, again the deputy chief counsel of the House Select Committee. The movie was shocking to me because it demonstrated the notion that the CIA was training, in America, a separate army, he said, again quoting, it was shocking to me because I'm a true believer in the system, and yet there are notorious characters in the system who are funded by the system, who are absolutely un-American. And who knows what they would do eventually. What if we send people to Washington who they can't deal with? Out comes their secret army? So I find that to be as contrary to the Constitution as you can get, unquote. And then you go on to add, what is even more shocking is what the film reveals. According to Tannenbaum, depicted in the film among the Cuban exiles was Guy Bannister, David Attlee Phillips, and Lee Harvey Oswald. Inexplicably, the film would later disappear from the committee's files. We've already touched on Bannister, and of course people know who Oswald was. Tell us briefly who David Attlee Phillips was.
Well, David Attlee Phillips was a career CIA officer who was at one time the chief of Western Hemisphere operations for the CIA, and he was very closely affiliated with the anti-Castro exiles. His history dates way back to the CIA coups in Guatemala and, of course, the failure at the Bay of Pigs. And in addition to Phillips being associated with the exiles in New Orleans and Miami, he was, according to a House Select Committee investigator, also spotted in Dallas, Texas, with Lee Harvey Oswald.
And you also mentioned David Attlee Phillips in connection with the Belle Chasse training camp.
Yeah, that's correct. It goes back to the training camps. In addition to Lake Pontchartrain, there were other training camps in the area, and one was the Belle Chasse Naval Station, which is south of New Orleans. And it's interesting that one of Ferry's associates mentioned to the House Select Committee that Ferry had actually trained at that camp. And what was interesting is a memo that turns up later, authored by David Atlee Phillips, explaining a little bit about that camp. And in that memo, he tells us that the training camp was entirely agency-controlled, and the training was conducted by agency personnel. So and I guess Ferry qualifies as agency personnel.
Right. Briefly, tell us about David Ferry and Eladio Del Valle.
Right. Eladio Del Valle was an anti-Castro Cuban exile who operated out of the Miami area. And it came to light that Del Valle was funding Ferry to perform certain operations, specifically firebombing the Cuban sugarcane crop out of Ferry's Piper Cub, for one thing. And it's also interesting that Del Valle also turns up dead in a mysterious way on the very same day that Ferry died.
And although there's been a dispute about how Ferry died, there's been no dispute about whether or not Del Valle was murdered.
That's correct. He was, I believe, bludgeoned with a with an axe and also shot. So
shot through the heart at close range, as I recall.
Yes.
And bear in mind, of course, that David Ferry was the first person that Garrison indicted in connection with the investigation. Speaking of David Ferry, the intelligence community and the anti-Castro Cuban effort in New Orleans, tell us about the Houma, Louisiana raid and the overlapping Santa Ana, that being the name of a ship. Connection.
Sure. In Houma, Louisiana, there was a it was an abandoned blimp base, and it was at that time operated by a company called Schlumberger. And stored in at this base was actually some weapons that were left over from the CIA's previous coups, specifically Guatemala. And the surplus weaponry ended up at the Houma bunker. And several of Bannister and Ferry's associates in a sort of a caravan went up to the Houma bunker. They had keys to get inside the bunker, so it was less a robbery than it was a weapons pickup. And the weapons, after first being like stockpiled in Bannister's office and so forth, ended up in the hold of a ship called the Santa Ana. Now, the Santa Ana was being leased by the CIA, and it was going to be part of the Bay of Pigs operation. Now, in addition to that, they also had a dangerous kind of side venture planned in that they had anti-Castro Cuban exiles dressed as Castro's troops on board that ship, and they were going to stage a phony raid on Guantanamo, the U.S. base there in Guantanamo, to force President Kennedy's hand in a full-scale invasion of Cuba. But fortunately, it never got pulled off.
Again, we should note that, in all likelihood, would have resulted in casualties among American troops.
Absolutely.
And again, there were going to be anti-Castro Cubans dressed as Fidel Castro's men to attack the U.S. military base at Guantanamo in order to precipitate an invasion of Cuba. We've talked about Guy Bannister and David Ferry and some of their connections to the intelligence community and the anti-Castro Cuban effort. Clay Shaw, who ultimately was indicted by Garrison after David Ferry died, and again, under very strange circumstances, Clay Shaw had many connections to the intelligence community. If you could touch on some of those, actually a long history of involvement with intelligence.
Sure. It dates back actually to his World War II years when he worked as an aide-de-camp to General Thrasher. He was involved in military intelligence type operations. After he got out of the service, he went to work at the International Trade Mart. At about the same time that the CIA was ramping up its operations as well in the late 40s, and it was about that time that Shaw started working for the CIA as a DCS contact, a domestic contact services contact. And during his various travels abroad, he would send reports back to the CIA on the political situations in various countries. And in fact, the CIA was, despite their denials, they did actually pay Shaw for some of his work in that regard. And later on, it was revealed that he also had a covert security clearance for a project called QK Enchant, which we still know very little about at this point. And the official story was that his contacts ended in the late 50s, but as the CIA documentation reveals, he still had an active covert security clearance as of 1967.
One of the people who crops up in connection with this milieu is a guy named Guy Johnson, and you quote a lawyer who was infiltrating the left in the New Orleans area, and he had some very interesting things to say about Johnson, Clay, Shaw, and Bannister.
Yeah, that was a gentleman by the name of Tommy Baumler, and he said that, that Bannister, Shaw, and this guy Johnson really made up the political nexus in New Orleans.
And Guy Johnson, of course, was Clay Shaw's first attorney.
Yes, he was.
When he was indicted by Garrison.
And he was also a close associate of Guy Bannister's.
Right. Tell us about Lloyd Cobb and who he was.
Lloyd Cobb was essentially Clay Shaw's boss at the International Trade Mart. But like Shaw, Cobb has a very interesting background in that he was also utilized by the CIA for something called a cleared attorneys panel. What that means, I'll leave that up to your listeners because there's no further explanation in the files on that. But he indeed was also involved in some, you know, CIA fun and games in New Orleans.
Tell us about his brother Alvin, who was a very interesting character.
Alvin Cobb was an associate of Guy Bannister's. And was also closely associated with the Ku Klux Klan down there. So a lot of very, very right-wing orientation to all these people in New Orleans, despite the fact that you have this communist Lee Harvey Oswald associating with all these people.
Which, again, it just doesn't compute to anybody familiar with the American political landscape. Tell us about the Cobb brothers and Merrydale Farm.
Right. The Cobbs owned a tract of land just a little north of Baton Rouge called Merrydale Farms, and several of the people up there testified to the House Select Committee that they would see anti-Castro Cubans on the farm training in 63 before the assassination. And one of the interesting things that one of those folks told me when I interviewed him was that he went by the farm on the day of the assassination and found that it was mysteriously being closed up, and it looked like they were, you know, bringing in all the cattle and just closing everything up. And when he asked one of the foremen what was going on up there, he was advised to, if he knew what was good for him, he'd keep his mouth shut and forget everything he saw up there that summer.
And you mentioned he was still afraid of retribution 30 years later.
Exactly.
Tell us about Clay Shaw and Ferry and Freeport Sulphur.
Yeah, that's a very interesting situation in that Ferry and Shaw were, it was revealed to Garrison that Ferry and Shaw had taken a trip, a plane trip to Canada, and that the reason for that trip was in relation to a company called Freeport Sulphur and one of its subsidiaries, Moa Bay Mining, which had been shut down by Castro. They were mining nickel out of Cuba. And Shaw had had expressed an interest in working through Canada to open up a plant in Braithwaite, Louisiana, to bring in the nickel from Cuba. And it would, you know, circumnavigate the United States. It'd go through Canada. But what was interesting about that whole affair is that Shaw and Ferry are always mentioned in connection together with that association.
And there are a number of other evidentiary tributaries that connect many of these individuals as well. We've got just a couple of minutes left in this side of the interview, Bill. One of the many things that connect some of these figures is the Clinton, Louisiana incident. Tell us about that briefly, if you would.
That's right. again, north of just a little north of Baton Rouge is an area called Clinton, Louisiana, and it has sort of a sister township called Jackson. And in Jackson, during the summer of '63, Oswald was spotted first there in Jackson by the local barber, and Oswald was asking about getting a job at a mental hospital that was in Jackson at the time. And the barber referred him to the local state's representative, Reeves Morgan, and sure enough, Oswald shows up at Morgan's house. And Morgan tells Oswald, well, you know, I'm not so sure about the job, but if you become a registered voter in this area, it helps you out on your civil service test. So where does Oswald show up next? But in Clinton, at a voter registration drive. And there were several people, several African Americans, actually, on the streets that day because CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, had a registration drive going on. And with so many people out on the streets, they took notice of Oswald, and particularly how he arrived in town, which was he was in the back seat of a black Cadillac, which in the front seat there was a driver and another gentleman, and they took note of these folks as well. And later at Shaw's trial, several of them would identify the driver as Clay Shaw and the passenger as David Ferry, and of course Oswald.
And all of these things that we've been touching on in the last several minutes, of course, connect many of these people, supposedly not connected to each other and certainly not connected to anything having to do with the intelligence community or the assassination. That's the official version, of course, and I think you've demonstrated very clearly that that official version would be very good for spreading on a garden and very little else. We are almost out of time in this part of the interview, Bill, so we're going to continue with this discussion of your very important and fascinating book in the next half hour. We've been visiting with Bill Davey, the author of Let Justice Be Done, subtitled New Light on the Jim Garrison Investigation, published in soft cover by Jordan Publishing, and copyright 1999. For Bill Davey, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.